This is BBC Radio 4, and now it's time for Late Night Woman's Hour with Lauren Laverne.
Good evening and welcome to Late Night Woman's Hour. I'm Lauren Laverne. Tonight I'm going to be slipping on my kid gloves and attempting to handle the thorny issue of modern masculinity. It's a confusing business these days. The phrase man up is now a thing, but what on earth does it mean? Men have a multiplicity of options when it comes to their identities, but does this mean they're simply expected to do more than ever? If someone's described as a lad, is it a compliment or an insult? What role does biology play and where do society's expectations come in? Oh, and by the way, what even are those? Loads of questions. And if you've got any more for our panel, then please send them to us on Twitter with the hashtag LNWH. Mansplaining for me tonight, I have a panel of experts and adventurers who each occupy a different outpost of the male experience. Comedian Richard Herring created One Man's Response to the Vagina Monologues with his podcast, book and live show. Welcome, Richard. How's it hanging?
It's all right at the moment.
Yeah, doing okay. Good. Richard, we should probably warn sensitive listeners who may have tuned in that your podcast title was rather cheeky, controversial.
Well, it was, but it's interesting that you can say vagina monologues, and I mean, it was a slightly cruder word for that. I'll say talking clock, I'll call it.
The talking clock.
Oh, yeah, but it wasn't called
that. It
wasn't
exactly like the speaking clock, though, was it? We'll come back to that later. Yeah. Lincoln Jopp is a soldier who commanded the Scots Guards in Afghanistan and was awarded the Military Cross for bravery in Sierra Leone. He now works in the City of London for the global technology company Tungsten. Hello, Lincoln.
Hi, Lauren.
Welcome. Dr. Leighton Seal is a gender specialist and consultant endocrinologist at St. George's Hospital, where he runs an andrology clinic to treat erectile dysfunction. Thanks for joining us, Leighton.
You're welcome.
And the youngest member of our panel is Michael Payne, lyricist. Michael, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Thank you very much for being here. We also have philosopher Philip Blond, who runs the think tank Respublica. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome. Quick question to start us off, gentlemen. What makes you feel like a man? Richard, I'm going to start with you.
Well, oh, for me, it's just about the gender. Having a penis makes me a man, and the rest of it is up for question, I think.
It's just the penis for you?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
I don't think there's much difference between men and women.
Keeping it simple, right, all right. Lincoln, what do you think?
Well, at the risk of controversially agreeing with the panel so far, I agree. I think I got a Y chromosome. There's a load of nature and nurture that happens after that. If you asked me to nail my colours to the mast on one thing, it would probably be taking responsibility, but, you know, show me a woman who doesn't do that to you.
Absolutely. Michael, what do you reckon?
Gonna have to agree with the first two. It's purely the fact that I have a penis that makes me a man. I think I know irresponsible men, I know irresponsible women, I know responsible men, responsible women. I don't think your gender really determines exactly how many of the sort of classical quintessential male virtues you possess.
Okay. Well, a lot of penis so far. You can get one up from that. I mean, you know, there's a bit more complexity there, isn't there? Can we reflect it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, as a gender specialist, I don't think you do need a penis to be a male. So there are the various ways around that. But I suppose the reason I think I'm a male is because I need to fix things. I always remember with my wife when she used to come in from work and telling me about her day, and then I'd instantly go into, right, well, you should do this, this, and this, and this, and this. And it took about 5 years of marriage to get to the point where she said, no, I just need for you to listen. I don't need it solved, just listen. So I think that was the first time I really kind of sat up and thought, it's not the same.
Took that in half a decade, so got there eventually.
Eventually.
Good news. Philip, what about you? Same question. What makes you feel like a man?
I think being a man makes me feel like a man. And I think the question strikes me as a little odd, because it sort of assumes that there's a neuter position out there where we're kind of neither male nor female. And
we have that's comparison,
yeah. That's the primordial position. And then somehow, through an act of volition, we choose our sex. And I think that's just palpably nonsense. I think that nature's a given. I think men and women are demonstrably different, not just through various appendages, but in all sorts, from any level of biology to culture and behaviour. And I think it's very dangerous to start to, and damaging to start to kind of use words like we're the same when we're not. Because what actually happens is if you say that, one part that isn't the same pays the penalty for assuming it's the same. And if we want a decent and just society, I think we need to recognise our differences and create equity and equality around recognising those differences and catering to them. Whereas I think what's really dangerous is the easy assumption that we're the same when we're demonstrably not.
Okay. We know where you're coming from to stop, but this is good. All right, so let's take a look back before we race too far for you. Tell us about when you were growing up. I mean, how similar was the boy you were to the man that we're all admiring here?
I think, well, I did a show called Headmaster's Son. My dad was my headmaster, and I did a show trying to work out whether the reason I turned out how I am is because of that. But I kind of realised within that show that all the things that I was obsessed with, which were comedy and sex, and I was obsessed with sex and the differences in sex as a four-year-old, which was long before my dad was a headmaster, and I was obsessed with making people laugh. So I think there's a lot of nature within a person, and I think you are, you know, and I've got a daughter, and you can sort of see the personality of that person coming through before you've really put much in.
Okay.
So I think, you know, I think I don't think anything really has massively changed. I was sort of always a bit cheeky and always kind of fascinated by things that I wasn't supposed to know about.
Who were your role models back then?
Well, when I was... I mean, I always just liked comedians. And so my granddad, who was funny, who I think was very influenced by people like Charlie Chaplin and stuff, I liked anyone who was funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked anyone I could make laugh. So it was more than that level. I loved Tiz Was. You know, anything that was crazy. I loved Lenny Henry and Chris Tarrant and... And as a teenager, I was into comedy rather than music.
And so. Were they all men? Because, I mean, you know, comedy, especially in those days, was a pretty male world.
Right? There were mainly men, as to say, but, you know, only because no women were allowed to do comedy. Really. I'm sure there must have been women amongst them. And now all my favourite comedians are probably 80% women, actually. Mm-hmm. And as a social person, I've always enjoyed being with women more than with men because I like talking and listening and men and talking about more than just football. Well, I don't really like talking about football or sport or music I like chatting about stuff. So I've always enjoyed the company of women.
I'd love you to expand on that.
You're on the right show. Lincoln, what about you? You know, you're a former colonel, spent 27 years in the military, and that's where the phrase man up comes from, doesn't it? I mean, what kind of environment was it?
The army, when I first went into it, was incredibly male-dominated. I remember the first ever woman that appeared in the Scots Guards was called the assistant. She was turning up to start her job as the assistant adjutant. She was an officer. And she walked into the barracks, and she was on her way to report for duty to the adjutant, and she got wolf whistle out of the guardsman's accommodation.
Wow.
And... you know, this is 27 years ago, and she, officers, generally speaking, don't go unannounced into the boys' accommodation. It's a high-risk strategy, particularly for the only woman in the Scots Guards. And she didn't blink. She went straight in. She called out. She stood in the corridor and said, "I want to know who just did that." She roundly bollocked them, took their name, and said, "And I'll be locking you up later." She turned up in the adjutant's office, who welcomed her to the battalion, and she said, "I think I ought to let you know that I've just locked one of your guardsmen up." Now, that was the first, you know, women getting wolf was fast forward to 2010, and we're in Afghanistan, and we're living cheek by jowl with the Afghan National Police in the Helmand River Valley, and we've got women taking every bit as much risk as the boys are. But undoubtedly, it's a very male environment. But it's becoming more attractive, I think, to women soldiers.
Okay, you won a medal for bravery. What happened?
I was in Sierra Leone in 1997. I was there doing a job working for the Foreign Office, and there was a coup, as there always seems to be in Sierra Leone, and we had to run some evacuations. We were running one out of a particular hotel called the Mamayoka in Freetown. And there were about 500, 600 civilians there. And we got attacked by about 170 bad guys. And I was very lucky. I was alongside a former SAS mercenary. I was less lucky in that I was surrounded by 30 Nigerian soldiers and we managed to repel the attack for long enough that a ceasefire could be brokered. But I got shot in the process, and but you know, that was that story.
Okay, Michael, what about you? You grew up in Hackney in the 90s. What sort of man did you aspire to be when you were a kid?
I don't think I knew at the time. I just liked what everyone else kind of liked. It just, there wasn't very much available to us, if you like. And there were a few paths that you chose. And I knew a lot of drug dealers, obviously. I knew a lot of MCs. But I don't think I had a clear sort of perception of the man I wanted to grow up to be. I think it just kind of happened.
Okay.
I had four sisters, so I was very protective over them, even though one of them is older than me, but I was still very protective of her.
And was it musicians that you looked up to? You know, you mentioned MCs. Did that come into your life pretty early? The music?
I looked up to my big sister, to be perfectly honest with you, and not just because this is women.
You're getting on the right side. I see what you're doing.
No, I looked up to my sister, genuinely. Don't think I looked up to really very many males, to be perfectly honest, or any. Okay. Not even my dad, as much
really?
As my big sister.
Okay. Leighton, you're a gender specialist now, but you had sisters too, as I understand it, and spent your formative years in South Wales with two older sisters. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. So I grew up on a council estate in South Wales, which was a fairly tough environment. But the male role models, there weren't that many, to be quite honest. I mean, I was the only person from my entire year at school to get to a university. So for me, it was more of a negative experience, really, in that I could see the people I did not want to become around me more than somebody that I aspired to be. Mm-hmm. And my sisters were a lot older. So my sisters are 10 and 14 years older than me. So by the time I remember things, they had already left and gone to university. So it was a kind of strange situation in sort of being an only child in a family of three.
With this kind of older siblings. And were the roles very defined then? You know, you're saying grew up in a council estate in South Wales, and that's kind of a shorthand, but I want to make sure I'm understanding you correctly.
It was an interesting family in that my mum died when I was 13, but before she died, my dad retired early, so my mum went out to work. My dad did the cooking, and he was an electrician. She was a caterer in actually Marks & Spencer. She used to cut Marks & Spencer's knickers.
Right.
So it was just for that environment, it was I suppose a kind of strange household.
So slightly atypical from
yeah.
the start. Very interesting. Philip, I know that you're quite keen to define your terms here. So what does masculinity mean to you?
Oh, I didn't know. I was keen to define my terms.
You don't have to. If you don't want to. That's fine.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think it's clear that we have natures, but then human nature is very weird in the sense that part of human nature is having culture that can change what human nature is. That's the complexity we're in. I think it was Aristotle who said human beings are unique in the world because they are the only creatures that can rewrite their nature, and that's us. But I think what is demonstrably true is that we all have natures, and then we have cultures that either allow us to flourish or actually really suppress us and destroy us. So we live in a world now where actually the group that's doing the least well are white working class males. Actually, if you bracket out in education, for example, they are the most disadvantaged group. For instance, amongst those who have free school meals, only 28% of those of white working class boys get 5 GCSEs, but it's 39% of black boys get 5 GCSEs. So we live in a world, for instance, where masculinity, particularly for working class boys, is in terrible, terrible trouble. And what's interesting about that is, and if you read their narratives and their accounts, and I do, they're people whose sense of identity is completely out of step with the culture. They're completely out of step. They're not valued and they feel very defensive. And they also deeply value themselves because that's their sense. So we're in a tragedy with some males that we're not allowing them to express their maleness that actually creates massive kind of inequalities and damages for those people. So paradoxically, and you know, we're in an age where if you really want to talk about the most oppressed group, it's actually, as I said, you know, working class white males.
Not challenge that, but question that a bit, because my soldiers were white working class males predominantly.
Mm-hmm.
They joined the, they had no GCSEs, lots of them, and they joined the army. You say they were suffering from some sort of gender identity crisis, and yet they, the guys who I saw coming into the Scots Guards, I didn't perceive that.
No, and that's, it's a really interesting point, because the army is one of the great agents of social mobility. So actually, if you look at the American army, for instance, it was the first to integrate. And also what's interesting about the army is it still creates a space for white working class males to do well and to succeed. What's interesting is that space doesn't exist, I would argue, really anywhere else in British culture. So what's interesting is what can we learn from the army about the acceptance of white working class males, for instance, and is there a way of creating that sort of space elsewhere? Because the jobs have gone, the physical labour has gone, education has largely been feminised at great cost to these boys. And so that, I think, is a really interesting question. So I'd take the army as something we could learn from and try to blend into kind of other structures.
Does that mean, though, that we need to go back to where we were before? I mean, you know, it's not necessarily a good thing to return to the way that things used to be. You know, of course, I recognise what you're saying. Mm. And, you know, I'm from the northeast where, you know, you had a whole kind of societal structure that, you know, was predicated on heavy industry. And then when that went and when that changed, you know, you do see young lads struggling to find a place where they fit. But is the answer necessarily going backwards? I mean, just because we're kind of facing challenges, it doesn't mean that we need to go back. I mean, maybe we need to find a new way. Michael, you're the young member on the panel here. You know, what kind of challenges do you think that young lads are facing these days?
I think what you said was interesting about things being feminised at education, you said specifically. And I think there is, like, you know, as we've sort of, throughout the course of history, you know, the most masculine things have been things including, you know, like, you know, violence, like the, you know, the army warfare, and, you know, hunting, and do you know what I mean? But, you know, now, as we've moved forward, male icons, the perception of a male icon, I think, has kind of changed radically.
Mm-hmm.
I personally think that humans are sophisticated animals, basically, and males are gonna want to do things that are classically, quintessentially male. And when you kind of remove that, and it puts them at an odds, and yeah, they do have this sort of like gender identity crisis, if you like, and they don't know exactly what's required of a male,
okay,
if you like.
And do you think it's down to this kind of too much choice? Do you think there are too many options? Was it, you know, was it better when it was simpler, when you knew what the rules were?
It's not actually what it is that actually what they value and those cultures value is no longer valued by the dominant culture. That's what it is. That's what's happened to kind of working class kind of male communities, that they go into institutions outside of that and everything they believe in and value is looked down upon, is repudiated and is sneered at. And the difficult thing, and you're quite right, you can't go backwards, but by the same token, it's very difficult to see how human beings can leap forwards from where they are. Yeah. And if we're not going to just simply abandon people, which largely is what we're doing at the moment, we've got to come up with some other alternative, and we don't know what that is.
I mean, obviously, you've talked about, Lincoln, the fact that, you know, you see young soldiers that you've led coming to the army and kind of finding their place there. Is that something that you felt as a young man, you know, when you were a young soldier?
Well, I mean, the reason why I joined, I was, you know, despite going to a very nice school in London, I was a tearaway at that school. And I was leaving, I think I was 15 or 16, I was just about to leave one day, to the end of the day, and one of the masters grabbed me and he said, "We've been discussing you upstairs in the common room." And I thought, that's never going to be a good thing. And he said, we think that you've got a spark of leadership and you need to think about how you're going to use that in your life. And so with all the arrogance of youth, I went away and took his proposal and gave it all of 12 hours consideration and came back and thought that the two purest outlets for leadership were either politics or the armed forces. My stepfather was a politician. I'd had a little bit of an insight into that world. I thought it was a fairly nasty, dirty, backstabbing world. I had no view on the military. I think I'd seen Tunes of Glory and the Guns of Navarone and thought it was a clean, pure and honourable world. And so I almost sort of went into the army as on the basis of an intellectual exercise, that it was the purest outlet for leadership. Leadership was what was the reason I was going into it.
Okay.
Not that I wanted to be a soldier, if you know what I mean.
I do know what you mean, yeah.
And so that's what got me into it. And I found it was a huge, huge privilege to be in a position to be able to work with some of the most extraordinary men and women in, you know, bright, funny, intelligent, tough people who form the most incredible teams and do the most extraordinary things.
Okay. You're listening to Late Night Woman's Hour with me, Lauren Laverne. We're talking tonight about masculinity, what it means to be a man in the 21st century. There is a hashtag. It's LNWH. Ricky Gervais has been in touch on the hashtag and asks, accompanied by this picture, what makes a man? Is it lots of sandwiches? And then that is, I would describe that as a mid shot of Ricky, from a very low angle, where we're looking at his torso. How would you respond to that, Richard?
No,
terrifying. I feel slightly scared. For the first time in my life, undermined in my masculinity.
Well, in one of my shows, I did talk about Rudyard Kipling deciding what a man is, and I said Mr. Kipling was closer to know what a man was, which is making lots of cakes and eating them. So Ricky's definitely gone towards that.
But it also proves that breasts are not a defining characteristic that are different between men and women.
Ricky, thank you so much for the tweet. It's a very powerful image, and I'm just going to keep that next to me for later. So thanks. So we are talking about masculinity. Leighton, can you tell us a little bit about the biology of all this? In layman's terms, how much of being a man is physical as opposed to cultural?
Well, I mean, if you look at the development of a human baby, we all actually start off the same. So when the egg is fertilised, there's an X and a Y. But all that does is it sets up a pattern so that the baby can actually start making testosterone. So it's actually testosterone. If you look at the genetic level, there's a gene called the sex-determining region of the Y chromosome, which we all call SRY, which is actually expressed for 4 hours. So it takes 4 hours to make a man.
Okay.
Other than that, because the baseline template is female. So without the influence of testosterone, the genitalia develop into a female pattern. So the fetal testis then has to make testosterone. And that action of testosterone on the baby's body is what gets everything to differentiate into being male external genitalia and male internal genitalia.
And what about the brains? What about our brains? Because apparently male and female brains are different, right?
Absolutely. So if you look at a fetus at about 16 weeks, so that's just at the end of the first trimester, the fetus is producing adult male testosterone levels at that point. And by this point, the genitalia have actually formed, so they're already finished. But what's developing at that point is the brain. And if you look at the baby's brains up until about 4 years of age, they're identical. But then what happens is the brain starts pruning. So like a large tree that gets pruned down. Certain areas in males are bigger, certain areas in females are bigger. And it's that testosterone production in the uterus that then sets the pattern. And a lot of these changes are around the part of the brain that controls the hormones, called the hypothalamus, which you would expect. I mean, women have a monthly cycle, but we actually have a biannual cycle. At the moment, our testosterones have been low for the last 3 months. So we've all not been in the last 2 months. We've not been interested at all. And this month, our testosterone is going to go up. So our sex drives are going to go up.
Really? And what, like, all men? That's so everybody's the same.
So we have two peaks.
Michael's nodding here. I wonder what was going on.
Cool now, all of a sudden.
You're nodding in recognition.
Leighton, tell me more about that. In the same place, like all around the world?
Northern Hemisphere.
So we have two
peaks. We have a peak in October, and we have a second peak in February. And our nadir is June, July, August. But what's interesting is our waistlines.
That was my best time.
Our waistlines going back to the
Edinburgh Fringe.
Sorry, go on.
So going back to Ricky's picture, our waistlines actually follow it as well. So as our testosterones drop through the year, we get fatter in the middle. And then as the testosterones rise again, we'll get skinny over the next 2 months.
How absolutely fascinating.
Incredible.
That's incredible. That is incredible. Wow.
Wait, come on, woman.
It all makes so much sense.
You feel like you've been recycled.
I've been recycled. There you go. I was in a cycle I didn't know about.
There you go. It's played
like reading science fiction.
Richard, your podcast about the penis began with the assertion that all women have one.
Well, they do. Well,
explain
yourself. This is the same thing. This is why men have nipples and there's a great Stephen Jay Gould short explanation of it that works very well. But yeah, the clitoris and the penis are the same organ.
Absolutely.
And so the clitoris is a micro.
I like how now that you're saying it, and it's not on your podcast. You're kind of looking.
I want to make sure I'm getting it right.
Go on, back me up here.
But we women get a super sensitive micro penis, and in many ways better than a penis. And men end up with some superfluous nipples. So women have definitely won this. This battle.
It's
about 13 weeks in or something like that that it all kicks in. But
It's complete by 12 weeks.
Is
so
okay?
We're ambiguous up until about 9 weeks. Hmm. So
okay.
It's the same structures until 9 weeks. You cannot tell the difference between the genders of a baby until 9 weeks and then at 12 weeks. And actually, you're right, the nerve ending density is about 10 times higher in the clitoris to the gland. So it's basically the top end of the penis shrunk down to a clitoris.
Okay. Yes.
It's all the same.
So if your girl ever tells you, you know, penis is too small, you can say, well, it's not as small as yours. Hopefully.
All right.
I can't say that.
Leighton, tell me about the other aspect of your work, which is erectile dysfunction, because we have another, and I find this statistic quite surprising. Apparently, erectile dysfunction affects 40% of men over 40.
Absolutely.
Is that right?
40 over 40.
No laughter now.
Define
erectile dysfunction.
The
inability to produce an erection that is satisfactory for sexual performance to your own satisfaction.
Every time.
But to your own satisfaction, though.
Yes. I mean, it's a purely arbitrary definition. If you feel you should have sex once a month and you can achieve that, that's fine.
Mm.
If you feel you should be having sex four times a night and you can't, then you have erectile dysfunction, as simple as that.
So
I'm
tell
fine
me
then, that turns out I'm fine.
Tell me about the impact that this can have on people's lives, because it's huge.
I mean, it has a profound impact. I mean, erectile dysfunction, it goes up to 70% by the age of 70, so it's an almost universal finding. So when you look at guys who have erectile dysfunction, there's an increased risk of suicide in these guys. They actually earn less at work, because sexual function is so intrinsic to a man's idea of who he is. They often feel that they are less when they have erectile dysfunction. So their confidence goes. They feel that the people around them are better than they are. So it's not universal, but it's certainly a common theme that I
have
in
patients. Does it follow the other way around? So if you earn a lot more, you're less subject to these problems. Just an interesting.
Well, I'm broke as hell.
Or if you're broke, you're just knackered.
Yeah. I've got nothing to lose.
You can't reproduce.
It's actually height.
Really?
Tall people earn more money. Yeah.
There you go.
But certainly, if you
but isn't it short people make the best military leaders, Napoleon?
This is like becoming like a weird Randy Newman song. I'm going to move us on. Leighton, there is this reported increase in erectile dysfunction among young men. And, you know, some people have been blaming this on hookup culture, on porn, on, you know, lots of different kind of things. Is it something that you're seeing in your work?
Oh, absolutely. There's a whole tranche of men in their early 20s that are coming through now with a mainly psychological cause for the erectile dysfunction. The average age of a boy starts watching porn is 11. So, then by the time they've had 5 or 6 years worth of watching pornography, and to then actually be confronted with the sexual act, I mean, you have to kind of think how you internalise that.
Mm.
The average straight man, the only erect penis he's ever going to see is in porn. And those guys are not anatomically correct. You know, they've all got six packs. They're all absolutely huge. The women are beautiful.
Not Ron Jeremy.
I don't
Ron Jeremy looks more like Ricky Gervais in that.
Good for him. Then
he's from the old days.
Yeah, so. True.
But go on.
And then, well, actually, I mean, there's a whole difference in porn culture. If you look at the porn culture in the 70s, the men were all ugly on the basis of ugly men can have beautiful women.
Right.
Whereas now, if you look at the body beautiful culture, which is actually affecting men's psyche now, the porn stars are now body beautiful, because that's the expectation of men now.
Yeah.
I mean, is the availability of porn these days good or bad for men's sex lives? You know, I'll throw it out to other people. Michael, what do you think?
I think it's good for the non-existence of a sex life, to be perfectly honest. I just to interject, actually. So you know what you're saying, that this was this based on a survey that you said the average boy. So the average man first was first exposed to porn at 11, because sometimes I feel like, you know, it might be a bit, if it's based on a survey, people might just say it's a lot younger than they actually, you know, say they were a lot younger than they actually were.
Oh, so
they're
kind
were.
Of bravado type thing, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's the same with any research, but I mean, this is the tyranny of the modern telephone, isn't it? You know, before you'd have to log onto your parents' computer with a dreaded search through the history. Now, if you've got your phone, you know, you learn how to delete your history before you actually learn how to use the phone itself properly.
I mean, Richard, all this stuff is stuff that men find quite hard to talk about. But you did say on your podcast that men love talking about their penises. Where is the kind of cut-off point for what they're happy to...
Lots of perplexity then.
all this is very interesting, because men will talk about nothing else, but they won't talk about it seriously.
Yeah.
So in my show, which was a comedic show, but I realised that was a great way of addressing these issues, because men will laugh at it, but actually when you come down to it, there's all these things. Pretty much I did a survey, an anonymous survey online, got lots of funny answers, lots of very sad answers, lots of tragic answers, but like nearly every issue, a third of men were, whether it was erectile dysfunction, whether it was urinating next to another man, whether it was you know, worrying about the size of their penis both ways, and men really having their lives ruined over these things, because it's treated like, as a joke, by men and women. And I wanted to do with my show, I found the Vagina Monologues is a fantastic show, but it's very much for women. And I wanted to do a show that was for men and women. I didn't want to do a show that was, aren't men the best, really, and aren't we the oppressed ones? I wanted to do a show that was about, look, the future is men and women need to work together, and we do work together. I think, as a man, when I did that show, I felt women kind of didn't like men and didn't like penises. And then, you know, the astonishing statistic was like 94% of women love men and their penises. Of course they do, you know, so of course they do. But men, we're so kind of, it's so ingrained in us that's not the case. So men are very sensitive and worried about these things, and there's a lot of tragedy in it. And I think then they're trying to conform, actually lots of men are trying to conform to what they think being a man is. And yeah, because it's biological, this culture, this society, we're all on a spectrum of being men and women. You know, we're all got bits of, we've got bits and pieces of each other.
You know, you mentioned tragedy and the kind of sadness there, but as a comic, like, that's where a lot of a particular kind of laugh that I think you like to pursue is. Like, you like that kind of slightly transgressive moment. And thinking about this, and you know, just thinking about you coming on the show, I was wondering, well, maybe that's part of the attraction of stand-up for male audiences. You know, maybe it's a place where they can talk about those kinds of things. Is that relieved laughter, a different kind of laugh and a different kind of joke?
It can be. I mean, I think comedy's just, again, it's great because everyone can do it and everyone has a different sense of humour and everyone's welcome. And what's great about comedy, and as in the army and probably everything else we're working in, is that now women are, you know, it's not like, oh, you can't do that, which it was 20 or 30 years ago. Oh, you're not allowed to do that. That isn't your thing. And women, of course, are funny. You know, just, so you go to America, especially now, and you go, oh, hold on, all the best comedy is women, because the best comedy is about character, and it's about understanding, and it's, you know, and so all the Tina Fey and Amy Schumer and Amy Poehler in America.
I guess they're doing the same thing. You know, they're talking about the things that we don't speak about. They're naming things that don't have names.
It's all this stuff about, isn't this all a bit, if you forgive the term, isn't this all a bit overdone about penises and stuff? I mean, it all seems to me to be really missing the point. The real issue about kind of males and masculinity is to do with status, with image, which how men feel they ought to be versus how they're actually performing. That's where the real crisis is.
Masculinity and femininity, and I think that we're both trying to conform to the stereotype. And that's what I really found from this stuff. I think the most insecure men are the ones who are the most trying to be men, and the most insecure women are the ones who are most trying to be the feminine, pretty women. And actually, everyone in the middle is a mixture of these two things. You know, and so, you know, there's male and female attributes that are ridiculous, but I can't read maps, for example, so that's meant to be a female thing.
Can I just to give a, you know, different, more practical bent, I think crucial to male-female relationships, I think, particularly for males, is the notion of provision, particularly when people partner and when they have children. And that's kind of has evolutionary and biological, as well as social, cultural. That's been with us since the beginning of humankind. And what
we don't really know how it's divided up in the Stone Age. We don't know what male
Well, we've got fairly good evidence.
We don't have. There's no evidence.
No, but if
yeah,
you
yes, like, yeah. Sorry, I mean we
no
we
evidence
do,
of
we,
social. Of what, how socially things were divided up.
We do. I read it. I know about it. We do. We know that some people have surmised that women's higher language skills are to do with brokering functions, men's better spatial senses are to do with hunting, but that's not the point. The point I want to make is the real issue we face in this culture is we've got like hangovers of what males feel they ought to do that they can no longer perform in society. We've got a situation where status used to be widely distributed and people used to, men particularly, used to feel they could fulfill that status through work and providing income and permanence, and that's no longer available to them. And that's the level at which I think we should discuss things rather than talking about penises. And we should talk about kind of what are we going to do socially and culturally when the economic and social options for large numbers of males are no longer there, and yet the identities upon which they find themselves and found themselves actually rely on it. And that's where I think the crisis is.
Well, that, you know, thanks for moving me on. We were going to talk about that. We are going to get to that. We'll talk about
that. I'm just
so
bored by all this penis stuff.
Well, we needed to...
What are you trying to say?
We needed to cover...
I'm trying to say that it's not... I don't view it as fundamental or foundational. I don't think it's as... Although I completely appreciate the points about... It obviously has that role, but I don't think this is... where the crisis is really to be found. I mean, if
but
you look
the
at the
biology
of
gender is an interesting subject, and it's, you know, that's
yeah, but you know,
but what you're saying, we have to go back to the previous society, because if it's not about that, you know, I think the thing is to realise that all these things are a step forward. So yeah, there's been a massive technological change in the world in the last 20 years that's very hard for anyone to cope with. That's changed all of our roles. That means that men aren't needed. Men aren't required anymore for anything.
They're
not required to lift things, because machinery can lift things. They're not required for war, because
it'd be a better conversation than some sort of physical kind of reductive conversation.
I don't think so, because I think most of those men's things will come back to sex anyway. So I don't think. I think to dismiss the sexual side.
I'm not
of it
dismissing
is,
it. I just don't think it's that crucial.
But it also shows. Okay, I think the point is that it shows how sensitive men are, and actually that men are pretending to be something they're not being. And that's why.
Okay, guys. Well, I think I can make you happy, because I have a kind of social role that it results from sex. So let's talk about fatherhood, and then hopefully you'll both be up for that. Richard, how much does fatherhood change you as a man? What kind of father do you aspire to be?
Well, it's an amazing thing to happen. I've left it late, as you have as well. We both left it late in our lives, and we both got young babies. And It sort of changes. It changes the meaning of everything. And obviously, you're in control of it and responsible for another human life. But it's an amazing thing. But I sort of don't think it's any different than being a mother either. You know, I mean, there's obviously the difference of not having born the child and given birth to the child, which is an horrific, awful thing for anyone to have to go through. I sort of just feel very lucky, and I think a lot of these changes are lucky, in that my parents' generation. My dad wasn't really involved. My mum was giving birth to my sister, I think, and my dad was listening to cricket in the other room, and the midwife is saying, keep it down, think of your men folk.
Oh,
and, you know, and I think that changed, that now a man, and I feel my dad probably wasn't as, who was a great dad, but I don't think he was as involved as I am with my daughter. So I think we're very lucky to be in a modern world where we can co-parent.
Lincoln, what about you? I mean, how has your position in your family changed and evolved over the years as you've grown up? And grown older.
Well, I think when you become a father, things change undoubtedly. I remember, so I've got, I must have started earlier than the rest of the panel. Excuse me, Leighton, I don't know that. No. So I have a 20-year-old, an 18-year-old, and a 10-year-old.
Okay.
And I remember when Albie, my son, our son, was, we were taking him out of the hospital, and there was this really tricky thing on the wretched car seat, you know, the baby seat, and it just, you know, you could almost shortcut it. But that wouldn't be how it said it on the Britax instructions. Other car seats are available. And I looked into his eyes, you know, all of 12 hours old, and he just looked at me and said, with his eyes, I'm kind of relying on you to do that tricky thing with the belt. Mm-hmm. And, life changes as a father. And it brings with it huge joys, wonders and challenges and sadnesses as well.
And what about, you know, in your wider family, you know, with your own parents? I don't know if you faced the you know, losing a parent.
My father died 7 years ago. And it was extraordinary. My dad was 83, I think, when he died. And he was, you know, he was quite elderly and slightly infirm. But there was I was talking to my brother about it today. And we both felt this extraordinary sense of being propelled onto the front line of the family. It wasn't as if he had in any way been the provider or been the backstop or the safety net, but he'd been there and he'd been our father. And when he went, all of a sudden this additional responsibility somehow just seemed to appear from nowhere, and you were the guy on the front line. And I'm sure if I were, you know, if my brother were my sister, I'm sure that she would articulate it in a similar way, but probably with different terms. So I'm not saying this is a man thing, mm-hmm. But I do think that it is a thing.
Okay. Philip, what do you think? How much has the role of men in families changed in recent years, and has it been for the better, in your view?
Well, I think many, many things have been for the better, but it's a question of for whom. I mean, one of the things that's particularly interesting if you, for instance, track male-female wages, females are overtaking males in all the young deciles. They're outcompeting males at school and at wage levels. Up to the age of 30, female wages are ahead of males. And female wages drop and create the gender gap when women have children. So women have children, generally speaking, they don't go back to full-time work, they do part-time work, and they lose touch with the leading edge of their careers. So, and they don't recover. And part of kind of what I think has gone wrong, for instance, with feminism is first wave feminism. It's largely modelled on patriarchal assumptions, i.e. we're all the same, women are like men. So we didn't create, particularly in this country, enough maternity rights to protect women once they had children and preserve their career structure. Now, what I think that marriage and bonding actually reflects is, again, deep evolutionary, social and cultural, which is at that point when you marry and you have kids and you bond, it's absolutely crucial for men to provide. And that you feel that crucially. And I think that remains a very important part of a male sense of self-worth and of a vitally important role. Now, that have changed for some families now, of course, but I think for many it hasn't. And again, I'm repeating the point that when you create a world in which males can't do that, that's your crisis of masculinity.
I hear what you're saying, and I hear what you're saying, but, you know, you're talking about the kind of crisis of masculinity and the traditional structures and traditional roles as being a place where people can find freedom and they can find this kind of fulfillment. But they were also a form of social control, you know. They kind of kept people in their place, and men were oppressed by them.
And
too.
If men feel like that, they're right, they're not right about it, you know. So it's not a biological thing. It's like, actually, if you do go, oh, actually, my baby's more important than my job, I have to maybe earn some money, but so can my wife, and actually spend some time with your baby, which I think a lot of men don't do, and I'm lucky enough to be able to do because of the way my job works, I agree with that. Then, you know, then actually that's much more, that's, but you know, look, I sort of feel like I might stop working and just look after my baby.
You're missing the point. The point is that the destruction of a settled family traditional unit, which is celebrated as liberating, as, you know, a huge act of liberation, has actually been disastrous for those who've it's been enacted on, particularly for working class family structures. We know from all the evidence that kind of familial breakup and breakup and non-presence of males has all sorts of invidious consequences, from crime, from education, to drugs, to addiction. We know it's hugely damaging. One of, I think, the most recent interesting developments is the family has actually been reinvented as a deeply socially progressive organisation. Now, of course, it should be modelled on equity. I'm not trying to defend. Nobody's defending something where women don't flourish. I want both men and women to flourish. Let me be very clear about that. But what we have done post-1960s is we've thrown the baby out with the bathwater, if you forgive the language. We said, let's destroy the traditional family. And what that has destroyed is essentially forms of stability that human beings need, particularly at points, crucially, when people need stability at points of child rearing. And unless we can recover that, unless we can recover the idea as the family of, as progressive, we're not going to solve some of the deep-seated inequalities that are present in our society. So middle-class people love autonomy, they love screwing everything, they love shopping, they hate any idea of anything that limits their autonomy. But that preaching of autonomy has been death to working-class people, and it's that that has put nails
Michael,
in their coffins.
Can I bring you in here? I mean, you know, what do you think, listening to this? I mean, growing up, what was the kind of family culture that was surrounding you?
Well, I was going to say, well, the traditional, like, nuclear family, my parents are still together, right? And I think a lot of that has to do with their culture. They're both Nigerian immigrants. They came over here in the 70s. But I think a lot of it, in addition to culture, has to do with religion. They're staunch Catholics. I'm not religious. And I hope they're not listening. Because I never told them when I started going to church. But I don't have very many friends that... whose parents are still together, you know, and the choices that they've made in life widely vary. Some have turned to crime, yeah, but some have both parents still together. I think in modern society now, like nowadays, from what I observe, is that there isn't really a formula to sort of parenthood and how to rear a child to be, you know, responsible and not turn to, you know, crime or any other sort of negative things that society throws at them. And I personally think that if you are,
there probably is. I mean, you know, actually there probably is a formula, and it's stability. And it's whatever can create stability. Mm. Now, there's different things that create stability, money, familial structure. Mm. But actually, one of the hallmarks of those who suffer in our society is rampant instability. Mm. And it's whatever causes that is the enemy of social progress.
But then is that to say that nobody from a stable home has ever become a mass murderer?
No, generally speaking, if you look at the indices, those who do best, and it's so marked that... it's not really, I think, questioned. Those who do best, the word I use is stability, that captures all of those class, social, cultural and familial advantages. Marriage is a huge advantage. Yeah. Marriage is a huge agent of social mobility and social progression. And that's part of the stability. It's not the whole thing. And you can have stability in other ways.
OK. Michael.
Think of a scenario where there's a set of parents, a mum and a dad, who've been together for, you know, 20, 25 years, whatever. They've got kids who've grown up, who are growing up, and even though they're together, the wife is oppressed by the husband, for instance. Even though that, you know, they could both be, there could be a stable upbringing in that the parents are both earning. You know, they're above the breadline, you know, the kids are in good schools, but there are just, the reason I'm saying there's no formula is because you look at all these statistics is looking at things at face value.
It depends what indices we're looking at as well, because, you know, Leighton, you mentioned height earlier. So are we going to look at height and how we can make people taller so that everybody gets richer? I'm being facetious, but you know, you see my point. It's complex.
I think it is complex. I think there are, I'm very torn. I agree with some of your arguments. I think there has been a tyranny of feminism on women. You know, my wife grew up in a generation where she was expected to go out, earn, be as good as a man, do everything a man did. And to be honest, my wife has earned more than me up until very recently, right through our careers. And yet come home, keep a house, look after children. So women growing up in that generation couldn't just do one part of this, she had to do all of it. But I do.
But maybe that's where men are now. You know, that they just have this kind of dizzying, like plethora of things they're supposed to be.
But I do
be,
disagree. It's an intrinsic thing that the man has to go out and provide.
No, I'm not coming
from a household where, and both households where that didn't happen.
Okay. Okay. I mean, what about social responsibility? Because, you know, in spite of what you're saying, men hold the power of the reins of power. Women only make up 30% of the cabinet, 26% of positions in overall government. Do men have a responsibility to make the world a better place for women? And how interested are they in doing that? Richard, what do you think?
I think equality is good for everyone, you know, and I think women know what they want from life. And love is, and men know what they want from life and love, and all of us being able to be who we are and not being forced into stereotypes, is an amazing thing, and is where we have that potential to create that. I think we have the potential to create a new world based on equality, and then sometimes the father can
just
go and do work
just
on
as
the mother
a counter
can.
To this, and I don't is we've had this language of, you know, from the 1960s. You know, tune in, turn on, drop out, kind of from Marcuse's One Dimensional Man. Just do what you want and it'll all turn out well. And it hasn't and it doesn't and it never will. we've got to stop the idea that whatever we want, whenever we want it, leads to an aggregate better world, because it just doesn't. What it leads to is a world where those who are best positioned get everything they want and those who aren't get even less. Part of... what I think we need to do is recreate structures of solidarity. So what's missing from all of the radical talk? Everyone just talks about themselves. Nobody talks about solidarity. Solidarity across the sexes, solidarity across nations, solidarity between human beings. And until we can recognise that the family is part of solidarity, and I'm not in favour, and I don't believe that families are necessarily oppressive. They can be, and I'm against that. And I want to create, but family is part of human solidarity. And we've got to have that, and we've got to have wider forms of solidarity. One of the great things about Britain is, as we were all saying earlier in the green room, it's one of the least racist countries in Europe, because we have a civic culture that doesn't believe in race. So that is a form of solidarity that we all are enormously grateful for. And what we have to fight is the idea that the sexes have different teleologies and different goals and different achievements that they can be pursued separately. That's what destroys our society and culture.
I'm a bit confused. I thought when we started this conversation that almost was the position you were coming from. So I must admit, when I sort of, you know, was invited onto this program, I had to look into, you know, do a bit of research, and I was surprised that there was this thing called the crisis of masculinity that's gone on. And bypassed me, I've got to say, for the last 20 years.
Well, we've barely scratched the surface of it tonight, and we're almost out of time, I have to say. Unfortunately, there is another programme in here, I think. Thank you so very much for being with me tonight. Thank you very much to my guests, Richard Herring, Lincoln Jopp, Michael Payne, Dr. Leighton Seal, and Philip Blonde. It's been wonderful to have you with us. We're going to be back next Thursday night at 11 with a late night look at women and lust with Nikki Hodgson, historian Hallie Rubin-Hold, sex therapist Michael Usada, and Catelyn Moran.
Late Night Woman's Hour was presented by Lauren Laverne and produced by Rebecca Myatt. Now here's Jenny Murray.
On Weekend Woman's Hour tomorrow afternoon, the actor Charlotte Rampling on why she insists her photo should not be airbrushed.
You get touched out. I say touched out because, you know, you lose your personality. You just have a false face. You're selling lies. You really are.
Charlotte Rampling on Weekend Woman's Hour tomorrow just after 4.
But now, here's Fee Glover with today's final visit to the Listening Project.
What would you say if your husband described you as being lazy and suggested that your poor attitude to life might be something that you should work on? I know, I might have an Ofcom moment. But this is part of the chat between Stanley and Sonia, and the ease with which 73-year-old Sonia takes on board her 80-year-old husband's criticisms of her is perhaps what makes their long marriage a successful one. The charge of laziness refers to Sonia's diminishing interest in cycling. She and Stanley met through their local cycling club in 1959. Stanley is a fierce competitor. He once took part in the Empire and Commonwealth Games. They walked through a tunnel of wheels at their wedding in 1963, so I think you can see how important the spokes are. But when they came into the Listening Project booth in Jersey, they wanted to discuss how that's changed a bit, Sonia being less competitive now. Stanley, though, showing little sign of slowing down.
It was really our life. The cycling club was our life.
Yeah. Because then it wasn't a team event, it was individual, wasn't it, really? Every time you go out, you used to try and beat your own time.
Yes, it was you against the clock, and it was your own body. Could you push your body to go faster or further? Not anymore. Oh, I'm exhausted at the thought of it. Life got in the way of my bicycle and ended up at the back of the garage.
I'll get you back on your bicycle this year because I don't find you do enough exercise.
Oh no!
And when you do, when you go out, you stop every 5 minutes.
Yes,
where, to me, I want to get you going to get you fit.
You've got your mum's genes. Look at you, 80 years old, and outwalk me, outcycle me, and most people. Son-in-law in Australia, he can't keep up with you on his bike.
Well, it's the only way to get on in life, isn't it? And so you have to push yourself.
I don't look for pushing myself.
No.
Perhaps I'm just lazy. I think that's half what it is.
Okay. But I think we'll have to try and get you out of that.
I'm pleased in a way that the three children have all inherited more of your genes than mine, because they've all pushed themselves.
Yes.
They've all done very well. They've all reached their full potential. No, I think
they thrive all the time to improve themselves.
It's a good job they didn't inherit my way of looking at life, because they'd be pretty well stuck in a rut. So really, I can see myself stuck in a rut, but at 73, I think, well, I'm entitled to be.
No, we must try and get you out of that.
I think if I had more motivation, if I wasn't so lazy, if I got up at 7 o'clock every morning and there's nothing to stop me, I could cycle my bicycle through our estate and there's our cycle track.
Wow.
It's not the road.
Next week I'll do your bike, pump up your tyres and get you started. You'll have no excuse. Your tyres.
It's not even
up.
A hill.
No.
But,
and we'll get you back racing again.
Oh. But it is only miles in our legs, isn't it?
We'll get you back into cycling again.
Now we've actually talked about it. Now I've actually confessed to you what I should be doing.
I'll make sure it's carried out.
I guess that extra oxygen to the brain, the exhilaration, the blood flowing
through your veins better.
Because they do say once you start exercise, you don't want to stop it.
But you
it's just the starting
start.
That
right.
comes difficult to me.
Yeah.
Yes, okay. I expect it'll all come back again. It's like riding a bike.
10 miles a day.
What?
Stanley and Sonia, recorded by Joe Loosemore.